This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is, God, what day is it? Thursday, March 16th, 2023. I'm Jeff O'Neill here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from BookRiot.com. I'm recording at 7 a.m. my time, scheduled shenanigans. Rebecca is gracious enough to move around. I'm a little on the early side. I get up early, but I'm not recording podcasts at 7.
Yeah,
on those days.
Functioning at 7 a.m. is a lot. I was just thinking that, like, you know, in our younger and more vulnerable days when we wanted to mix things up, we recorded at like 9 p.m. and now it's like, let's be wild. 7 a.m.
I mean, 7 a.m. is easier for me than 9 p.m. these days. I've been asleep for an hour.
That's true. Yeah, it's 10 o'clock here. My caffeine rocket ship is still like in full blast off mode, so I'm ready to go.
Got some stuff to do. Not the heaviest week in the world. We got some stuff to talk about. But before we get into that, let's take a sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge strategy and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Got a couple of listener feedbacky kind of things to do. A lot of people having feelings, rightly so, understandably so, about changing books, you know.
Dahl,
that whole situation here. Ian Fleming, a story came out this week. I don't have in the show notes here. I think maybe it's worth talking about in detail once I've had a chance to read it. But the publicist for Ursula K. Le Guin's estate said that some changes made to Le Guin's books for somewhat similar reasons. And it feels like it falls a little bit between the Dahl case, which is Dahl had no part of it, right? Dahl was kind of a bad person in a lot of ways. And the Fleming case, where he actually was changing some of the words himself. This was maybe Le Guin said she authorized it or was talking about it, or it's something other than cut out of whole cloth. So I guess this is maybe more widespread than we think here. And we'll find out. I think people are going to come out with these stories as we see. I'm not sure how to deal with it. I still think people seem to get on board with our sense of, having a hard time summarizing our sense is, I get it. I get why you're wanting to do it. I think it comes from a good place. Is it missing the forest for the trees a little bit? And shouldn't we just move on? And is there a bright line between the author doing it, saying this is the second edition? Because this is something that happens. Like Walt Whitman, like 17 editions of Leaves of Grass. And those, you know, each had an introduction, an addition, and we can kind of chart through history. It does seem like there's a very strong opposition to this becoming the only document, like the living, you know, this is the new document. It's the one that's on the shelves. It's the only one you can buy. And everything else is sort of, I guess, archived that no one can see. So I get that. So I guess it's my new thing. If the author wants to do a new issue and change language to be whatever they want, in any case, do that, write an introduction, and somewhere in that book say what was changed. I think I'm okay with that. Beyond that, I'm getting nervous.
Firmly where I am. I want transparency for readers and for posterity of what was changed, why it was changed. I was thinking about this yesterday because I got a PR email notifying me that a 30th anniversary edition of Girl Interrupted is coming out. Oh, and so first of all, I had to have a moment that Girl Interrupted is 30 years old. And then I, you know, took some time to think about the fact that we let 10-year-olds read and watch stuff 30 years ago that we wouldn't today, because I definitely was familiar with that when it was a fresh, you know, property. And I have no idea if they've done anything different with this 30th anniversary edition, but it seems to me like that's a book that would be a potential contender because it's about mental illness and how we talk about mental illness and issues of mental health and body image and eating disorder. All of those things are so different and have developed not just over the last 30 years, but really intensely over the last like 5 or 6, that I could see a lot of possibility for something like that that's had enduring interest, where they are, you know, going to do a big anniversary edition. If the author or anyone, you know, near the book says, hey, you know, like for reasons of social responsibility, we want to update this, but let's also, I think, just notify readers. It kind of it comes back to also how I felt about, you know, Go Set a Watchman, which we've talked about from here to eternity, is just tell the readers the truth. You know, your favorite, treat me like an adult and tell me what the scam is. Like, just tell me this thing isn't a sequel. This was a draft and she never wanted it published. Tell me this guy was racist and now we're taking the language out. Or, like, we believe that it would be in line with this person's values to change the language because they, you know, were in line with the values at the time and those things have shifted. How we honor that has shifted. Just tell us. Just tell readers what's going on. And then it's less of a thing. I think where it gets complicated is when it feels like something's being done, or like people are trying to like pull one over on you, or like, we're just going to change this and hope that no one remembers that historically this thing was filled with like fat phobia or racist language. That's not cool. Let's not rewrite history. But acknowledging progress and wanting to change with it, I can totally get behind. Let's just like document how that's going. Can we track changes on these things?
Yeah,
that's what I want.
There you go. I like that idea. Yeah, two things occur to me. The first is, in a lot of ways, this is an issue of copyright when you think about it, because the only reason these estates have the, I guess, juice to make these changes and then make this the authoritative edition is because they control the copyright. So there's a lot of issues around copyright, and I want writers to get paid. Does their estate need to get paid for 60 years after their death? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not really sure how to do this. I'm sure if I had a best-selling book and put differently, if my grandfather had a best-selling book, I'd be more interested in protecting copyright. But how about that? This would never happen, but we're going... Wait. Oh, you know what? It's just under the bell here. The Court of Rightness starts session at 7:15. I think I can get a rule. Let's see. Here we go. Let's say you do... We were taking Matilda, and if you change Matilda... And you're the estate, fine. But then what happens is the original text immediately goes into the public domain. How about that?
I like that. Yes.
Because once we're in the public domain, no issues. People can do what they want. You can make whatever editions you want. And there becomes a thirst, I think, for the authoritative original version, right? Like, okay, I know people can do whatever they want, but what is the original recipe chicken really looking like here? So I think that's a way of thinking about what this is really about. I don't think most of the time this has anything to do with the artist's vision. This is about legacy and selling books. And once you put it like that, I think some of the issues become more clear, because it's also true that because of the way texts work, you can do this, right? It's not like people are going to go, you know, Van Gogh... You know, the colors
in that... We got to touch up those sunflowers.
Yeah, you know, there's something about the hands in the Mona Lisa that's always bothered us. So the idea, the thing about the text is it's replicable, right? The printing press, blah, blah, blah. One of the great things about books is a paperback is a good of a reading experience as a first edition, right? You get the same reading experience because of mechanical reproduction and Walter Benjamin and all that stuff. But what it also means is there is no sort of going to the Louvre and seeing the real McCoy, because it's an idea, right? It's a code. Right. It's a sequence of text strings. And so it's a very, very strange way of thinking about how these things are. Because I don't think anyone would be like, you know, we really need to go take a look at the girl with the pearl earring. And where's her ear really like that? I think it'd be in the spirit of the artist that we, you know, change that. Now, they clean it up, right? You get the soot and dust and everything off of it. That's a thing. But in terms of actually altering it, I think we're right to be like, huh, I wonder about this. I think we're right to wonder about it.
Well, I think you're right to hang a lantern on the sales incentive, because we're not getting notices like this about books that came out 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years ago that have been dormant. And someone's like, you know, I just think we should update that thing because it's passé or offensive. Now, it is happening to texts that have consistently sold for a very long time in most cases, and where there is a vested financial interest in having them continue to sell. And you know, I think the most generous reading of that is someone deciding if we're going to continue to put this thing out in the world and it should at least be, you know, caught up to the times. The least generous reading of it is someone recognizing, oh, we're going to sell fewer of these because people find this offensive, so let's update it. And other forms of art, you're right, are not subject to that same incentive, especially stuff like the Mona Lisa. Like, that thing is not going to be sold again anytime soon.
Right.
It is where it is. There's not an additional market for the Mona Lisa.
The Louvre would have to be in dire financial straits. If you know what? Which of these could we move? Wouldn't that be the last pick in the draft? It probably would be for the Louvre. It'd be the last thing in the Louvre.
Right. It's the last thing going at the auction. Like, they're going to hold on to it until the very last moment. And folks want to go and they want to see those records of things. You know, visual art is such a way of documenting what the world was like. And so there's also, I think, less incentive to even have a conversation around, like, is this painting offensive? Like, maybe. Was it offensive at the time? Why is it offensive now? There's just a conversation. There's not the suggestion that kind of art should be changed. It reminds me, though, of like Disney, you know, changing elements of movies or just straight up taking some things out of the vault that can't be saved.
Song of the South, right? That's the example.
Right. Yeah. Where it's just like, we can't even we can't figure out a way to sanitize this thing. We're just going to not make it available. Wow. And I wonder about like musicians are maybe the closest corollary. Like there's language in songs from 30 years ago that we don't use now. And, you know, at least in my life, my understanding is people just don't sing those parts out loud anymore. Yeah. Or, you know, maybe you just don't listen to that song because now it contains language that you would rather not have going into your ears. But I wonder if there are examples of musicians with long careers and long catalogs who, like, do they change those lyrics up when they perform them live now? If they recorded a like best of album, would they switch it? Would be really interesting. And I guess if anybody's listening and knows of something like that that's happened, I'd be super interested in it.
Yeah, we'll move on. Podcast at bookriot.com. Another thing you said, this is not on the topic, but I've had this thought for a while, and I want to get your take on it. The comment you made about 30th anniversary of Perks of Being a Wallflower made me think, I don't know if there's something about I'm sorry, Rebecca, I'm looping you into my generation. A few years. Our generation or modern sort of adulthood where we seem particularly susceptible to the, can you believe X thing came out N units of time ago, right? Like I'm susceptible to this. I see this. Can you believe it's been 40 years since whatever and 50, you know, 50 years since Star Wars or whatever? Is this new? Were our parents like in 1982? Were they like, oh, can you believe Sing in the Rain came out 30 years ago?
Well,
it doesn't feel like that's a thing.
I think there was just less exposure to that stuff because they didn't have the internet perpetually reminding, like digging it up and reminding them. But I did.
They don't know what year it is? Is that what you're saying? Our parents were oblivious. They had no idea about time.
No,
they were neophytes. They were temporal neophytes.
Yes, that's,
every day
that,
they woke up,
temporal.
It was a new day.
Yeah, that it's Groundhog Day. I just read a study about this at the Times. There was a piece in the Times. I'll try to find a link for the show notes. But some psychologists were looking at like the question of how old do you feel in your mind? Like how old are you on the inside? And they found a really, really consistent pattern that on average people say that they feel inside or they think of themselves as about 20% younger than they actually are, and that they attribute some of the like real sticky nostalgia that happens in middle age to that thing, to that phenomenon. So I don't know if that's related, but what I'm thinking about is like when my parents were the age that we are now, they weren't getting up in the morning and seeing like on the front page of the Kansas City Star, it's been 50 years since Singing in the Rain, you know. But there's just like this, we're able to like stay in touch with pop culture now and pop culture in the past because of all the ways that the internet lets us dredge things up and then disseminate them widely, that it's been this long since that thing. But I remember like my childhood, my parents were kids of the 70s, or they were they were young adults in the 70s, and my childhood was all the music that they listened to in the 70s, in the same way that if I had kids, my kids would be growing up on like Counting Crows and Third Eye Blind. So I don't think it's new. I think we just see it differently in a magnified way because of what
nostalgia has been around. I mean, that's the Greeks, baby. I mean, that's a few millennia. I think the eternal surprise of, I guess that let's call it the internet generations, and you can throw up what the post internet generation seems to be more surprised about the passage of time than any generation before it.
Maybe
we're the temporal neophytes. Our parents were cool.
Maybe
like, we're beings going through time and space, and things happen, and then they're old. And but now we're like, oh my God, can you believe?
Yeah,
been 14
I mean,
years since you know,
right. There
know,
is a part of me that if someone
out?
Right, if someone says like this thing happened 10 years ago, there's a part of my brain that's thinking like, oh, you mean in 2004?
Right. Yeah. So anyway, that's a bit of a digression, but it has struck me. It's like,
weird.
Was Herodotus saying, it's like, man, it's been, I can't believe it's been 150 years since the fall of Syracuse and Alcibiades. Anyway.
Wow. Alcibiades, your coffee has kicked in. Good morning.
Or it has it. I think about Alcibiades.
Didn't have that one on my bingo card this morning.
Yeah, it's you get other things going on there. Okay, so thank you for writing in, everyone who wrote in about that. Other kinds of... I do want to mention the deep dive again. Rebecca and I have pieces up. That's Book Riot's Substack newsletter. There's a free edition that came out today. Again, if you don't know how Substack works, there's a paid version where you get all the sends, and there's a free version where you get some of the sends, so you can get them, and people who don't or can't or don't want to pay can get something, but also an enticement to get you to throw a few bucks to get the full thing. The edition today was kind of a grab bag, some recommendations from staff writers, some kind of fun things on the internet. Go check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes there. Rebecca and I also had a wonderful time on the most recent episode of the Book Riot Patreon podcast talking about power ranking the books of 1996. I think we continue to have fairly similar reads on the years.
Mm-hmm.
I think this time the way we spread the reads out was interesting. I had a much different number one than you did, but it was a good conversation. We got a lot of nice comments on there. Continue to really enjoy this format. So if you've been hemming and hawing, you've been on the fence, I think there's something on the other side of the fence for you with the power ranking in 1996 on this.
Yes, I agree with that. It was just bangers all over the place, 1996. And yeah,
not quite as good
ways
as 2000, but it way up there, way up there, way up there. So go check that out. I had another thing for you. ChatGPT-4 came out next week, and I guess the thing we're going to be doing for a while. And I continue to be largely nonplussed. Or which way is it? Am I plussed or nonplussed? My shoulders are down about it.
Right? I think
whatever
you're plussed.
That is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're just plussed.
Yeah, nonplussed means the opposite of what you think it is, which I know that, but then I get confused about, wait, it's like when you know how you misspell a word, and you're like, wait, is that the way I think it's spelled, which means that's my misspelling, or is that what I've taught? I don't know. You get this into a recursive
loop there. We are plussed and combobulated.
Yes. ChatGPT definitely knows what nonplussed is, but what it doesn't do very well on, so there was, you know, one thing that's happened is one of these new AIs come out, people, the PR department for OpenAI, whoever the hell this is, they put it through the battery of tests, you know, the GRE, the MCAT, the board exams, the law school exams. And this banged out pretty much perfect scores on almost everything except, did you see this?
No.
Did you see this, Rebecca? Okay. I'll just have to try to find a source. Someone sent it to me because, well, you'll know why they sent it to me in just a minute.
Okay.
So the AP exams, fives, except for two of them. And Rebecca, you and I, everyone talks about the robot apocalypse coming, and you know, you got to be a doctor or you got to be a forager to survive. It got a 2 on the AP language and language exam, and a 2 on the AP literature out of 5. Everything else 5s, it got 2s. We're all safe. Welcome, literary nerds. We did it. We're going to survive. The computers can't beat us. I'm going to live forever.
I feel really validated about my Noam Chomsky confirmation bias moment recently. Love it when the technology proves my point.
Yeah, and I didn't see anyone sort of explaining why, so I'm going to take a wildly uninformed stab. Welcome to the Book Riot Podcast.
Do it.
My name is Jeff O'Neill. Because, again, the LLMs, these are regurgitation machines. They are beautiful. They're the most efficient regurgitation machines that have ever been created for human knowledge. But the language and literature exams ask you to create something new. They ask for a novel interpretation of something. And it can't do that.
It can't do that, and it can't do style.
Well, it can copy style, but it cannot have a style of its quote-unquote own,
right,
so to speak.
Yeah, right.
Point.
There's
and
nothing...
I don't know what that would look like.
It can't originate a voice
because
it's a duplication machine. It can mimic or repeat or remix. You know, it can write you a song about what a 401k is in the style of, you know, like an 80s rap, which is a thing that I had it do. But
Bob's marketing emails are going to get wild here soon for you, I can tell.
I know the day that I did that, I was like, I wish you could use this for something. It's probably a good thing that financial communications are heavily regulated.
That's right. Yeah. For now.
Right.
More regulated than
just
the
a
banks,
giant
apparently.
Asterisk. Like, hello, clients. This week, my wife is obsessed with technology, and here's the news.
I gave her a quad espresso and a keyboard and a new login to ChatGPT-4.
Future girl is now freelancing in financial journalism.
That would work.
Hello, and welcome. It would be something. I don't know if it would work. It's this feels affirming and right in line with what we suspected. So I'm glad to see it, but it also seems like unsurprising and predictable that no one, even at ChatGPT, has said, yes, this thing can create beautiful new language or style. Like, they're being pretty straight up about what it is. And the sky is falling interpretations around it are exactly that, informed by other people's fears and concerns and, I think, uncertainty or lack of familiarity, or maybe just the thing where people read headlines and don't actually read the stories about what a thing can and can't do. I think there's a lot of that going on with AI in general. And yeah, it's not going to write you a beautiful sentence. It could probably write you a very, like, a C level, you know, average five paragraph essay.
So I don't know what that corresponds to. Is that, you don't get any college credit for that. I think if I remember my AP score correctly, and this is completely off the dome, and it's been, wow, can you believe it's been 20? No, I'm joking. I'm I think you maybe could get some colleges would give you a credit for a 3 or a 4. I know for a 5, I took a bunch of these and I walked into undergrad with a bunch of credits, which was great. And those were 5s. And I know there's a couple 4s, but I don't know. Anyway, it's not, you're not getting college credit for a deuce. Let's just put it that way.
Right. And nobody's throwing you like a scholarship because you got a 2 on an AP test.
No.
So it's passable, but that's it. Yeah. And I think that's the story about ChatGPT. It will give you the information in a passable way. If you've got to do a technical communication, or like, I had it write me some sample policies for things, like for various HR kinds of, I didn't use them, but I was just like, what would it look like if I was like, write me a sample policy about whistleblowers or whatever. And it does just pull from widely available stuff that when I Googled, like, I did some comparison just out of curiosity. Like, I Googled samples of those same things, and you can kind of trace back, like, oh, right, these are the common things that appear in this policy. Those things also appear in this ChatGPT version. And that's what you would get on a, I don't know, AP test essay question about what do the scaffold scenes in the Scarlet Letter mean. You're going to get regurgitations. You're not going to get someone's original thought about it, or a creatively phrased take.
I'll tell you when I'll worry about the chat, when I'm going to worry on, it's when ChatGPT-9 is like, can you believe it's been 10 years since ChatGPT-4 came out? That's what I'm going to worry.
Well, you know, since it's regurgitating what it feeds on the internet, it shouldn't have a very hard time getting there.
when ChatGPT is like, man, can you believe it's...
1993 was 40 years ago.
It's been 50 years since Nirvana's Nevermind came out. I'm like, yeah, you're right, GPT-7. You get me.
All right, well, moving on.
Speaking of things that... Okay, Filippo Bernardino, let's do it. We get the first new information that the text manuscript thief speaks, and what he said is so naive that it kind of breaks my heart.
I read the whole statement, and it is hard. Yes. It is heartbreaking.
Do you want to give the people the gist or give me lines, or what do you think?
Yeah. So Filippo Bernardini, who is that manuscript thief, he pleaded guilty this week, and he wrote a 5-page letter to the judge in anticipation of sentencing. His lawyer wrote a 13-page letter. Publishers Marketplace, Publishers Lunch linked to those. And I have landed in the place of, I feel very bad for this person. Had what sounds like a difficult childhood, really loved books in the way that, you know, a lot of folks use them as a form of escape and connection in a moment of difficult childhood, and like dreamed of working in publishing, had finally secured an internship at an agency and thought things were going well, but notes that like they were not going well. And he has difficulty, came to understand later that he has difficulty reading social cues and interpreting, you know, verbal feedback from people. So what he thought was going on was very different from what was going on. When he left that agency, applied for tons of jobs in publishing, came to find out later that the agency did not give him positive recommendations when his references were checked, and just was really longing to stay part of the industry and to feel like he was part of the world of books. He was like devastated by the idea of losing access to galleys. And that's where this whole thing comes from.
His dream died, Rebecca. His dream died.
Yeah. His dream died. That's where the whole thing comes from. And that he's like, you know, I had observed how my colleagues talked to each other, how they wrote, how they would ask for access to these kinds of materials. And so one day I set up a spoof email account, and basically the high of being able to get those manuscripts became addictive and compulsive. And he uses those words. He also refers to diagnoses related to mental health that have happened sort of in the interim. A lot of that material is redacted from the statements, but this is like, it had the, at first when the story broke, it had that feeling of like, what is going on here? Yeah. And we had been puzzled because there was no, like, it didn't, we couldn't understand the motive. There was no attempt to sell them. There was no piracy happening. Right. It was clear that this person was not like profiting off of this in some way. And so I think what we have here is a person who's dealing with mental health and probably some, it sounds like neurodivergent issues, and did not fully understand that what he didn't understand at the time that what he was doing was harmful. Like, it seemed like a victimless crime because he was the only one reading these things. His statement acknowledges that now he understands this. Some authors who were impacted have written letters to the judge as well, offering their take. And there's a, there are some interesting quotes from Jesse Ball, who was like, please don't send this person to prison. This is not
my guy, Jesse Ball.
I know. I thought of you when I was reading it. I was like, oh, thank goodness Jesse Ball's coming through and being really tender. Yeah. And I had a really complex response to this, because obviously it's wrong. It is fraudulent to, you know, present yourself as someone that you are not and to try to obtain these materials. People's trust was violated. It's scary to have your intellectual property stolen from you. And also, nothing else was done with it. It's not a totally victimless crime. The harms, though, are minimal to what potential harms from, you know, IP theft could be. And there's, you know, a lot of stuff going on with this person that sheds light on motive and I think what the response should be. So I ended up kind of feeling like a little bit bad for having talked about this in such a spectator kind of way, because he now also talks about how difficult it's been to be under the microscope, to have his family and friends contacted. Like, this person is suffering.
Yeah.
And that doesn't let him off the hook, but it does make a more complete picture.
I think from a generating sympathy from the lit nerd's point of view, what a document this is, by the way. I mean, this is crafted probably by lawyers. Let's not pretend this is anything other than that. And it's made for us to say the kinds of things we're saying now. Caveat.
Having said that,
what's the opposite of wanting to see someone punished to the fullest extent? You always hear that. They're going to be punished to the fullest extent. Can he be punished to the least extent? I don't want him off the hook. I mean, people...
Right.
There's an element of this. This is literature. No one cares. It's a white person. Let's look the other way. This is how systemic bias gets put into systems like this, by doing stuff like this. But also, we could look at it quite a bit differently. And we're also not lawyers. The court of rightness does not send down jail sentences. That's for the legal system to do. In the court of rightness has some sympathy for this person,
yes,
but does not authorize or dismiss what they did. I think,
right.
I think you and I can have a, there's a little twinge. Anyone that's worked in, I'm sure this is true in other industries too, but do you remember the first time you got a review copy when you were a blogger, Rebecca?
You feel special, man.
You feel like you have access. If you're a fan of the industry or any kind of industry like this, you get into a screening, you get a demo tape, you get an invitation to the soft launch of the restaurant. You feel special, and people like to feel special especially about the things they care about. And I can see how at this moment, when he could see his career paths evaporating before his eyes, that I can still get the books, that I can still scratch that itch. I can still nurture that feeling of being an insider and seeing what's coming out. And it got away from him. and mm-hmm. no one found out, and it seemed easy to do, and it became its own kind of high. I can this makes yeah. sense to me now in a way that it didn't yes. before, I guess is the easiest yes. way for me to say it.
Yeah, that, I agree with that completely. It seems like the perfect storm of yeah. kind of vocational awe around books and reading, wanting to mm. be able to tell a certain type of story to himself mm. about his identity and his career and his connection to books, and then, you know, committing the first crime, sending the first email, having it work, and having that intersect with mental health issues that lead to compulsion and not being right. able to stop doing it, and also not being able to fully comprehend what you were doing. Like, yes, these are documents created by lawyers, and they are intended to create sympathy and result in a lower kind of punishment, mm-hmm. and the lesser end of the punishment. I just do agree with that. I think on the whole, yeah. there wasn't a lot of material harm done. Laws were broken. No. That needs to be addressed. Like, just there is justice in a response here, but I'm on the Jesse Ball end of the response, and it sounds to me like you are as well.
Yeah. Let's see, where do we want to go next? Let's do our second sponsor break, because we could get into a couple of these things. Leigh Bardugo. So Leigh Bardugo, hard to play. I'm trying to connect, looking for a historical antecedent for Leigh Bardugo's career. Mm-hmm. She started out Shadow and Bone, season 2 coming out now. Yes. So it's the world's coming up Leigh Bardugo this week, because season 2 of Shadow Bone's coming out, and she just signed an 8-figure deal with Macmillan. And for those of you in the car without access to like counting digits on a calculator, so that's at least $10 million.
Yeah, right? Somewhere that's between 10 and 99.
This is a 8-figure multimillion dollar deal is redundant, but whatever. A slate of new projects to be published across multiple divisions of the company in a variety of formats, age categories, and genres. The deal includes work to be published with Flatiron, Nightfare, Roaring Press, First Second. So for those of you who don't speak imprint, Flatiron is Macmillan's what? Literary commercial, upmarket
yeah.
commercial, downmarket literary?
Adult.
It's one of the most important commercial fiction imprints out there. If not, well, that's a different pod. That's a Patreon. We can power rank it.
Yeah, but a lot of imprints. Like Oprah picks, a lot of Reese yeah. and, you know, Good Morning America yes. book club picks, that right. kind of stuff.
Right, right. Nightfire is Tor's, I think, Macmillan, is Nightfire? It doesn't matter. Nightfire is horror, I believe. Or fantasy / horror. Anyway, I'm getting lost in the weeds. Roaring Brook Press and First Second. Roaring Brook, I believe, is kids' books, and First Second is
graphic novels.
Yeah. Oh, wait, it just tells me. Sorry, I didn't even go to the next section where it tells me. That it gives me
I was not going to point that out, the second
Thank
part
Thank you
of
very
that
much.
Sentence.
You're very kind to me. Adult novels, horror, children. I got it right.
You did. It
took me
you
a while
did.
To get there. So... historical antecedent, Rebecca? Do you have one? Who's done something like this?
The closest that I can think of, except it spanned publishing houses, is the like slate of announcements we got about Colleen Hoover at the end of last year. But I haven't seen a single author have a deal like this with multiple imprints of the same house doing multiple categories, formats, and genres. The headline of this should really be "Get That Bag, Leigh Bardugo."
Are we looking at a proto James Patterson here? Is Macmillan looking to cultivate a James Patterson type figure? It would be smart.
It would be really interesting to see someone do that, especially in YA or like Bardugo's flavor of fantasy. Maybe taking on, I mean, the full James Patterson there is taking on co-writers and starting sort of book farm.
Maybe doesn't seem like that's Bardugo's personality. I mean, I don't know her or anything, but I've read her, and it doesn't sound like that what she'd be interested in.
Less interest in something like that from the upmarket readers that Bardugo gets. Like it's sort of mid and upmarket commercial fiction, and you have to be like pretty comfortable with the commercial end of commercial to be like, yeah, James Patterson outlined this book and it was written by some guy named Ted. And to like not care.
Yeah.
But if you want the Leigh Bardugo brand and the flavor and you're a fan of her work and her writing, that like that art quality, you know, like ChatGPT could probably write a pretty passable James Patterson novel. I mean, I don't know.
I'm sure James Patterson, they're thinking about a James Patterson situation of some kind.
Show title. I don't think that it could do a Leigh Bardugo. Like, there is a style. There is a vibe that you're coming for when you're coming for a Leigh Bardugo book. I think it's really, really smart of both her and Macmillan to be interested in experimenting with how you can shape and flex that vibe to be for adults, for teens, in a graphic novel, in horror, in something else. And I would love to see that from more authors who are doing, who are working in that like cross genre space already. What happens if instead of just, you know, publishing your cross genre lit fic fantasy with Flatiron, you take like, you lean more heavily into fantasy to do this thing, you lean more heavily into YA to do this other thing, right. But it's all connected. And I think then you do take your crossover readers with you, which is a James Patterson thing. You do get people to sort of follow you into whatever you're doing. I can't think of a better contender other than Colleen Hoover for somebody to make this happen.
Colleen Hoover is the most obvious one. She's already doing it. The most recent Colleen Hoover release has a, I don't remember, it has an ampersand in somebody else's name with her. I don't know. I haven't looked. I don't know what that means in terms of who was putting their fingers on the keyboard and how that all worked out. But I can totally see it with Colleen Hoover. Leigh Bardugo, let me try another mental model on you. What about Rick Riordan Presents? How about that? That maybe is closer.
Oh, yeah.
He's done these series, Rick Riordan, the author of the Percy Jackson and the Apollo series, a middle grade, really has a lane and really has dominated that lane in the post Harry Potter world. Does this, I don't even know what, it's called Rick Riordan Presents, but it's like, he doesn't write these. I think he helps pick manuscripts maybe.
Right.
And it has the author, they're the author of the book, but it has, it's somewhere between an imprint and a, I don't know, author kind of font style, you know, and type, but it says Rick Riordan Presents on the top of it.
I actually think the best analog for Bardugo is J.K. Rowling. That Bardugo is maybe closest to the new J.K. Rowling.
Right. And she did Casual Vacancy in those Galbraith things. That's interesting.
Yeah, and is like a multimedia empire at this point. Yeah. And Bardugo's doing that. It's the books, and the books lead to fandom that supports a Netflix series and a movie. And like everything that Bardugo's done in the last decade pretty much has been adapted or is in the process of being adapted. Mm-hmm. And those things are finding audiences and doing well. Mm-hmm. And that there's less of a frenzy around it because they're not for kids and it's not as big as Harry Potter. Nothing is likely to be as big as Harry Potter. But I'm reminded that like when the very first Leigh Bardugo books came out near the start of Book Riot, Kit Steinkellner, one of our original contributors, wrote a piece, about how the next place Harry Potter fans should go is to Leigh Bardugo. And I think that's what we're seeing here, that if there is an ascendant person to that throne, or even just like a throne next, like a junior throne, the silver medal level of the throne, Leigh Bardugo's headed there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this, and I think it's not a mistake that we're looking at genre, right? Spec-fic genre, that seems to be...
Magic and romance.
We haven't talked movies at all this year, but Everything Everywhere All at Once is like the trailing indicator that's been going on with books for the last 10 years, right? Of like this spec fic crossover genre, literary plus another category.
Right. That like mainstream media consumers are familiar enough with the idea of a multiverse to make a movie like that a giant hit. Yeah.
So Bardugo's statement is pretty interesting, talking about, when everyone wanted books about kings and queens, they rolled the dice on my team of six outcasts trying to pull off an impossible heist. And when I wanted to go someplace far darker, they backed me in welcoming readers to Ninth House. So she's giving a lot of credit there to Macmillan and being very gracious there. I don't know, once you've had a Shadow and Bone-like success and someone comes to you and is like, this is what I'm going to do next, you're like, you know what, Leigh? I don't think so. But...
Yeah, Macmillan took a chance and then has been smart, I think, to let Leigh Bardugo be Leigh Bardugo.
Yeah. So I'm glad. I liked the Grisha verse. I like this. I don't know if it has this duology of Hellbent and Ninth House. I've read them both. I really like them as well. I could, you know, there are people out there with big overall kind of multi-title giant dollar deals that I'm not going to read any of the books, or at least even pay attention in a passing way. But she's going to be the busiest woman at high school right now because she's executive producing the series. She's got all these books coming out. She's got the press for the Greaserverse stuff to do. Leigh Bardugo, I assume it now has a team to make the Bardugoverse a thing.
Yes.
So congratulations to her. Happy to see that. Where do you want to go next before Frontlist for? Anything else you want to hit?
Yeah, I just want to shout out the Lambda Literary finalists list. Lambda Literary is an organization promoting LGBTQIA issues in the world of literacy, books, and reading. Mm-hmm. And their annual awards are coming up. If you're looking to read more widely and more intentionally with LGBTQ authors and issues, this is a great list to start with. And a book writer named Susie Dumond has a wonderful debut lesbian romance called Queerly Beloved that was nominated. She's a finalist, so shout outs to her. A couple other things we've talked about on the show, Lost and Found by Catherine Schultz, yeah, which we book clubbed last year, is a finalist in the lesbian memoir category. How Far the Light Reaches by Sabrina Imbler, which I really loved, collection of essays about the natural world and relating her identity and understanding of, or Sabrina has they, them pronouns, their understanding of themselves and their identity as a non-binary person of color through sort of the vehicle of creatures they've studied in the natural world. And then Open by Rachel Krantz, which is a memoir about navigating an open relationship that I found to be just like a very popcorny page turner in some like, wow, you've made some choices way. And the open relationship is not the wow, you've made some choices. It's kind of like everything else that she does is nominated as a finalist for bisexual nonfiction. But there's a ton. There are a bunch of categories. Lambda Literary gets pretty granular in how they break out different identities and sort of different vectors of LGBTQIA life. So lots and lots of books are featured here, and it's a great place to start in any given year for looking at ways to incorporate more queer authors and ideas into your reading life. So shouts to Susie, big congrats to her and to all the finalists, but wanted to just call that out for anybody who's looking for a good resource. Lambda Literary is a great place to start.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff there. Let's turn to Frontlist Foyer. This is kind of dovetails on news that we didn't put in the agenda, and so maybe I can sneak it in here, but Oprah made her 100th pick this week.
Yes, she did.
Anne Napolitano's book called Hello Beautiful, which I read the blurb. I'd heard Dear Edward became a thing, and I don't really know why, and there was a big piece. Sidebar on a sidebar. The publicity rollout for this pick was like something I haven't seen from an Oprah pick before. Maybe it's because 100, but on the day there was the announcement, there was also a profile of Napolitano in the New York Times, which for the world of books is the coup you want for publicity. Is to
yes.
The profile, right?
That's what you want.
At the same time. And so this is clearly in the making. Again, continue to be fascinated, flabbergasted by whatever the pipeline that gets these books into Oprah's hands so that she can talk about them in her really immaculate white button down with her really sort of Professor McGonagall glasses look that she's rolling with. I'm into it. It's a real look these days.
I wonder if she and Ina Garten get their shirts at the same place.
Yeah. Do they go to the Wealthy Women of a Certain Age store and get these shirts?
It's like secret Chico's.
Yeah, it's like there's a trap door behind Ann Taylor's where you go down in there,
right?
And there's
and everything just
really
you add a couple
shirts.
Zeros, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, sartorial corner is not my forte, but here we go. And I was reading about the book because you know this is what I do, and this one is described as a retelling of Little Women, but it also includes basketball and people who are fans of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass.
And huh? I wonder. If a person like that exists.
I was like, huh, so this is sold to me, and I bought it, and I'm 100, or, well, it's on, I'm reading it on my iPad. I'm 50 pages from the end, And I almost, this is the kind of book that I'd almost want to do like a corner for or spend 30 minutes talking to you about, because I'm like, what is this book? Because it's not bad. It's not bad. And it's not objectionable. And I think that's what it is. It's not objectionable. It does give me Little Women vibes, but it's meant for adults. But it feels like there's a certain Arrested Development feeling to it, even though it has like suicide and estrangement from your families. And there's just something really strange about it. And I know you're going to surprise it, but my best way of describing it is going to be through metaphor. The first time I'm going to trot out this experiment for me. There's a place in Portland that has vegan donuts, okay? And I've had it before. And for my birthday a few years ago, I had friends in town. We did a donut tour, very Jeff stuff to do. Great time. Minivan and a donut tour. What else do you want in this sweet, sweet life that we have? And I bit into the vegan donut, and I was like, it's like a donut without a soul. Like, it is a donut, but like, it's like a diet version. That's not even the right word, but there was something missing. And you know what it was? Animal products. Like the thing that I like, you know, like
the donutness of it all.
And in reading this book, I've read it quickly. I haven't begrudged my time doing it, but I've having that experience of like, this looks and has the mouthfeel of like a literary commercial novel, but there's something missing. And I can't tell if that's a feature or a bug, because that's one thing I've learned in doing this and reading these kind, you know, call, you know, is it the Crawdads or the Colleen Hoovers of the world? The very thing that I think is a bug for other people is a feature, right? No, I think that's
true. It sounds
true.
Like, no, I think that's right. It sounds like you are whelmed by this book. Is that fair?
I'm not even sure how to think about it, actually. I'm confused. I'm like, is a vegan donut a donut for me? I mean, it is a donut.
This feels similar to maybe that Ann Patchett essay collection that I always trot out as the thing to give your mother-in-law because there's nothing objectionable. Like,
yeah, I feel like it's a step or two down from that, because on the sentence level, there's not a whole lot to recommend it. And maybe it's just vibes. You know, it's sisters and there's stuff going on and there's drama. But even when something very bad happens, it doesn't feel like it's that bad somehow. I don't know. It's very strange. And that it's a 100th pick, which you would think Oprah would be mindful of. I don't know. I find it a very curious book and a curious phenomena that Ann Napolitano in the New York Times piece, they made clear, like, she's been writing for a while. A lot of books never got picked up. And something about Dear Edward and this book, I'll be curious if people like. Anyway, that's enough of my front list for you. I'm kind of connecting it to this thing, but very, very curious.
That is super interesting. I saw those announcements come out this week, and the Little Women comparison was where I was like, well, not for me. So I'm glad that you're reading it. I was very surprised not to see Oprah do like a confetti cannon on the 100th pick for a significant Black author. And I've been also watching which is just what it is. Like, that's just an observation. I've also been watching the stuff around Dear Edward and the like, I think that's a thing. Somewhere maybe on this is not a fair comparison to her, but I'm going to make it anyway, the Nicholas Sparks spectrum of emotional manipulation, the reviews that I've read of Dear Edward, both the book and especially the Apple series, are like, this is a 5-alarm snot bomb engineered just to be a 5-alarm snot bomb.
Right.
And I'm not particularly interested or drawn to that kind of reading or entertainment, but a lot of people, it works for a lot of people. I think that is the thing that to me is a bug, but to a lot of folks is the feature.
Upmarket Colleen Hoover is not the worst blurb I could do, if you think about it in those terms.
All right. I had a banger of a reading week with the new Elinor Catton novel, Burnham Wood.
I picked that up because you were talking about it. It looks great. I'm going to read it. Tell me about it.
It's great. And this is my first experience with Elinor Catton because I did not get to the Luminaries the year that it came out. Someday I'm going to go back now that I've had a moment with her.
I'm glad for you. You think this is a thing. But Rebecca, you're not going to pick up an 800-page book from 22 years ago.
In my dotage, I'll go back to all those doorstops.
Is this
when
I'm memorizing song to myself?
Yeah. Yes, that's what we're doing. Just once
a
week.
Community theater playing the apocalypse.
Right. We're going to have a phone call Romeo once Juliet. A week when we're old, because we'll have been podcasting for decades, right? And you'll be reciting to me your new stanza of Song of Myself.
Post haste. Yeah, we're going to do that stuff.
It's fantastic. And I was hooked from like the first page of like, oh, I got you. She got chops. Like the sentences are great. But it's about a group of like gonzo eco-conservation activists in on the South Island of New Zealand, like younger millennials, older Gen Z kinds of folks who their whole deal is they like sneak onto people's property and then also access public property to stealthily plant and cultivate crops that then they reap and sell to like local businesses and farmers markets and stuff. And it's fueled by the like, no one should be able to own the land kind of ethos, and also kind of an F you, you're rich, you won't notice if we use a corner of one of your back acres to do this thing. And for the most part, like, they're right. People don't notice that they're doing this thing. But they become the leaders of this group. Mira and Shelley, who are best friends, become involved and aware of a big piece of property a couple hours away from them that has recently sold to a reclusive billionaire. Their plan is just sneak onto the property, you know, plant some crops in a place where no one's going to notice us. But they don't know that the billionaire hasn't actually finalized his purchase, and that his story about what he's doing with that property is all a giant conspiracy. What he's actually doing is trying to extract really valuable ore that is, you know, under the ground from both his property and the national park that it's adjacent to. So they get embroiled with this guy who's like, let me fund your organization. They don't realize who they're taking money from. He's like, think of really like Elon Musk vibes. If Elon Musk wanted to pretend to be interested in the environment, like that kind of thing is going on. There's like some suspensey, thrillery elements with this guy tracking them, and are they going to figure out who he is and what he's really up to or not? The people that he is trying to buy the land from, are they going to figure out what he's up to or not? All kinds of shenanigans occur, and it's like peppered with sort of elder millennial, which I think is the fair age category for Eleanor Catton, like elder millennial commentary on the kids these days and how they talk about things, which is kind of satisfying as well. It's just really sharp. I loved the writing. The book is really sharp. It's really funny, like just sharp and funny, and captures, you know, the like vibe and essence of a group of really idealistic young people who are trying their damnedest to do this thing that they think is right, but also, you know, live in a capitalist society, and the idea of somebody giving them a bunch of money would make things a lot easier.
Yep.
Groups like that have a lot of complicated internal politics, and you get some of that happening as well. It's really great. I had a wonderful time with it, so I'm happy to recommend Burnham Wood.
That's awesome. My the book that I finished, one of the books I finished this week, I guess it's kind of not dissimilar DNA, is called Your Driver is Waiting by Priya Gunn.
Oh, yeah.
Novel.
How was
it? It's pitched as a modern update of Taxi Driver, which it's been a long time since Taxi Driver.
Like a gender flip Taxi Driver, yeah.
I kind of only know the meme stuff at this point. I remember vibes. So the plot, I'm not sure. But the main character, she drives an Uber. So it's contemporary. And she gets into a romantic relationship with a well-heeled white do-gooder.
Okay.
And brings her one night. It's hard to know what the crux of the plot really is, and I'll talk about why I say that in a minute. Takes her to a party where some of her friends are, and there are people of color and queer and working class and gig economy stuff, and they're talking about a strike for the other Uber. It's not called Uber. It's called something else. I don't even know if they mention the name of – I don't think Guns does the thing of like making up the fake name of the company, so it even seems weirder. She just doesn't, we all know what she's talking about, right? It's Uber, Lyft, whatever. And this white woman thinks these people are dangerous, and stuff goes sideways. I guess enough left at that.
Okay.
And I can see definitely, you know, the taxi driver vibe, the gig economy stuff. This person, the main character, she becomes isolated and radicalized in a way, and then fixated in a way as well. It was good. I really liked it. It's funny as well, sharp as heck. Has a lot of elbows and edges, which both you and I like, and I especially like in this particular situation. I find myself most drawn in this book to the little interstitial vignettes that are just a little vignette about a particular passenger or a knight driving around.
Oh,
I thought that was the most interesting part. The A plot was good, but I found myself looking forward to, I picked up these three people and this happened. I picked up the kind of minutia of driving.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't read anything about the author. I don't know if she's actually done this. Having read this, either she has done this, or her ability for generative, creative detail is unparalleled. So either one of those things is amazing. But I really enjoyed it, and it's a writer for me to watch. It was a quick read and interesting. I don't know who's going to pick this up. I guess I don't. It's not quite genre enough to be genre. It's not literary fiction. It's not an easy read. Everything has a pink book cover with an illustration on it now, so I don't know that.
Yeah.
No, I'm not joking. Like,
I don't know what I'm supposed
to understand from books anymore about. Everything is good for a kind of Instagram, TikTok imaging, and there's a flattening out of cover design, I think, especially for these between commercial fiction stories.
It's very difficult to tell who a book is for from looking at its cover now. And that's not always been the case. You used to be able to get some useful data, or like at least the right direction.
Right. And a debut author of a mix, sort of falling between a couple of genres or categories, has always been hard. Usually that's the most interesting stuff to me, frankly. But I really liked it and was glad to have read it. I liked it. I found it much more stimulating than Hello Beautiful, for what it's worth there. All right, that's our show this week. Links to everything we talked about, bookriot.com/listen. You can email us, podcast@bookriot.com. Go check out the Patreon. Go check out the Deep Dive. We're getting ready to record next week's Patreon episode. Now, this can be, we'll let you who aren't subscribing next week know. We'll keep it a surprise for the subscribers so they can see it in their feed next week. We're going to do that. Rebecca, thanks so much, as always.